Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today, Joshua Levine is talking about the aviation heroes of the First World War.
Thank you very much indeed. Real pleasure, real honour to be here today. And it's very exciting to be talking about this particular subject because it's often forgotten about. It's very, very important. I was talking to Colin, who spoke to us this morning. He was flying mosquitoes. And he was saying how when he was growing up, when he was training, the people that he looked back to, the people, his heroes, the people that generation really held in high esteem were these people, the flyers of the First World War. So it's a shame they've been forgotten about, and it's my little job here today to try and bring the story back. It's worth pointing out, going back all this time, just the sheer excitement that flying represented in these early days. I mean, the first flight was 1903, the first powered flight. And so the men flying during the First World War were flying very shortly after that. This is a man called Duncan Grinnell Milne. He was a pilot with 16 Squadron. And in 1915, this is what he wrote in his diary. He said, "At 10,000 feet on a sunny afternoon with only the keen wind upon one face..." Oh, my white stick, excuse me. There we go. "With only the keen wind upon one's face and the hum of an aero engine in one's ears, it is hard not to feel godlike and judicial." Godlike and judicial. Bear in mind, he's writing in the middle of a war, the most vicious war that had yet been fought, the bloodiest war. And yet there he was above the clouds experiencing this kind of rapture. And I find that very interesting, godlike and judicial. Everything seemed small underneath him. The war seemed insignificant underneath him. I thought it'd be interesting to look at a particular day as we begin. Not just any day, 100 years ago today, the 25th of June, 1918. And just to get a snapshot of what was happening in the air 100 years ago today. So for example, you know, this is a reconnaissance report of a night reconnaissance that was carried out on the Western Front between Arras and Cambrai. It was done using parachute flares dropped by parachute. It would light up the ground, and it was very important to do that kind of thing. At night, you could see troop movements, troops coming into an area. You would get advance warning, and this was done in an FE2, rather like this one, FE2D. And this, we'll come onto this a bit later, but you can see that's what's known as a pusher aircraft because you've got the engine at the back, so it had a good field of both fire and vision at the front. And this gives a sense, night reconnaissances, how quickly things had moved on in less than 15 years. This is another reconnaissance that was being done on the same day. This is actually in the Middle East, in Palestine. You can see the enemy is scattering into wadis, the dry valleys. Here, moving on, we have a reconnaissance from the Balkans fighting against the Bulgarians. And here, interestingly, at the same time as that reconnaissance, this is an artillery observation report happening early in the morning. And what's particularly interesting about this is that these two men, Hubbard and Sibley, were doing something that their colleagues had been killed doing the day before, Lieutenants Graham and King. Just the day before, their counterparts had been killed doing this, but the job must go on. So this gives just a tiny little snapshot of what was happening in various theatres of war in the air exactly 100 years ago. Now, what I'd ask you to remember is that at the start of the First World War, aeroplanes were an entirely new technology. They were hugely dangerous, and they weren't trusted by the military authorities. So to give a sense of how the aeroplane might be viewed, the first person to fly in Australia, for example, was Harry Houdini. There was a real element of novelty, of showmanship, even a sense of trickery about the aeroplane. And at the start of the war, it was still unclear whether aeroplanes really had a military future or not, and if they did, precisely what they'd been doing. There had been maneuvers carried out for several years using aeroplanes as reconnaissance machines, but still, they certainly weren't trusted by the authorities. Give a sense. Here are some pre-war pictures from London Aerodrome Hendon. Now, Hendon is now the Royal Air Force museum. But before the war, it was known as London Aerodrome. It was started off by a man called Claude Graham White, who was a car dealer. And this is, you know, he saw an opportunity here to take advantage of this new coming thing flying. And you can see this is the kind of pageant that took place at Hendon. People, I mean, I remember finding a report of a man who used to take people on joy rides at Hendon before the war. And what he used to do, he used to tell the people they pay tuppence, and he would say to them, right, now, when you get into this aircraft, I don't want you to touch this. Once we've taken off, do not touch this, and whatever you do, don't touch this. And he used to say, the more scared I made them, the more value for money they felt they were getting. That's kind of the idea. Here, you can see this is an underground map, an underground poster, rather, for flying at Hendon. And you can see it's a joyful thing. There's a lady having a lovely time in the back there. And there's a lady having an equally lovely time. And here are two ladies having lovely times with a lap dog at the front. I don't know how many of those actually went flying. That may well just have been a picture opportunity. But all the same, it gives you a sense of the atmosphere at Hendon, a sort of mix between what? A Henley Regatta, and also the danger element to it. They had a sort of Formula One danger element. They used to run pylon races, for example. They'd set up pylons, and aeroplanes would simply fly flat around the pylons, as though they were, except on the ground, except, you know, several feet up in the air. So there was all kinds of activities that they created to capture the public's imagination, and they most certainly succeeded. Now, many of the flyers were real characters. This is a man called Samuel Cody. Now, Samuel Cody was the first person to fly a powered aircraft in Britain. He is an American, and he came over here with a Wild West show. He pretended to be Buffalo Bill's cousin. It was no relation to Buffalo Bill. He used to do things like shooting an egg off his wife's head and this kind of thing. While he was here, he got interested in balloons, and from there he graduated on to heavier-than-air machines, and he became one of the foremost flyers in the country, and he died very shortly after this picture was taken flying, because it was a very, very dangerous occupation. But you can see why aeroplanes were called at this time. Some people call them flying bird cages. The idea being they were festooned with so many wires that you could safely cage a canary inside there. They were extraordinary looking machines. Now these two men, that will come, we'll see a bit more of them, time permitting. That's William Morehouse, later became Rhodes Morehouse, part Maori. He was a pioneer before the war. It's both taken at Hendon, these pictures. All these pictures are taken at Hendon. I got them from the grandson of the general manager at Hendon at this time. And this is Tommy Sopwith. Now, Tommy Sopwith, you know, his fame really lies as an aircraft designer. But he was a real daredevil. He was a yachtsman. He was an ice hockey international. He was also a car dealer. He owned a flying school at Hendon. He only died in 1989, aged 101. But, of course, his name is associated with so many of the great aircraft of the First World War. So these young men give a sense of where the early members of the flying services came from. They were, to a great degree, adventurous, quite individualistic, not necessarily the sorts of people who conform, not necessarily the sorts of people who would be welcomed by the more conservative traditional services. So this is how rather an unusual military outfit, or in fact two military outfits, were created, because the army branch of the flying services was the Royal Flying Corps, and the navy branch was the Royal Naval Air Service. And they remained separate, as we know, until the 1st of April 1918, when they came together, not altogether happily, to form the Royal Air Force. I'm just quickly getting ahead of ourselves, but a lot of people were proud to be Army, they were proud to be Navy, they didn't really want to be part of a service with no tradition whatsoever, and also a lot of people didn't like the uniform. I read one man who described, he said, I cannot wear this uniform, I look like a character in a comic opera. So it wasn't necessarily people wanting to join together, but certainly at this stage of the war, the two branches were very separate. And just 9 days after the start of the First World War, 13th of August 14, 63 aircraft of the Flying Corps flew across to France. So they were so unreliable, the engines, that as they flew across the Flanders, they had to get to a certain height. They had to get to about 4,000 feet before they could cross in case the engine cut out over the channel, and then they could actually just drift down to landing. A couple of people were killed on the way to meeting at Dover before flying over, but the rest of them made it to France. This was the first man to arrive in France, a man called Hubert Harvey Kelly. And even amongst these eccentrics, this man was an eccentric. He was known as the gayest of all gay airmen. He used to fly always with a reel of cotton and a potato because he felt they would be useful if he landed behind enemy territory. I have no idea why. So they all landed safely at Maubeuge. This is a picture of him coming across. I wonder if you can spot him here. So this actually is taken in Yorkshire. So his squadron, two squadron, was based up in Scotland, and they had to fly down, first of all, to Dover in stages. They couldn't make the flight all at once, and here he's landing in Yorkshire. And what I love about this, I wonder if you spotted him. First of all, you've got all of these just bemused people who have no idea what's just landed in their field. I mean, they've never seen one of these before. It's just, you know, staring out into space. But then you also have this extremely flammable aircraft, which has landed here. You also have this hay bale, extremely flammable hay bale. And here you have Harvey Kelly smoking a cigarette. I just think that's absolutely, he wouldn't let health and safety affect him in any way whatsoever. So once these people were across in France, the question was, what role were aeroplanes now going to play? And the answer came very quickly, because on the 19th of August, 1914, the first aerial action of the war took place, and it was a reconnaissance. There had been this idea that aircraft might be useful for reconnaissance, but the upper echelons of the army, they saw very little future for aircraft. They just thought they were there to frighten the horses. And the War Office was particularly skeptical, because the War Office was primarily controlled by the cavalry, made up of the cavalry, and reconnaissance was the job of the cavalry. They certainly didn't want to be superseded. So the first two reconnaissances of the war carried out by Philippe Joubert in his Blériot, he later became an Air Chief Marshal, and Gilbert Mapplebeck in one of these B-2s. There is Mapplebeck. And here is his diary recording this reconnaissance, and it's really rather marvelous. He starts off by saying, I did not pick up my position on the map, and he goes on to say, Miss Nivelle, which you see here, Miss Nivelle arrived at a large town but could not place it on the map. On my return, I discovered this to be Brussels. That's the level of competence that the very first... and then he goes on my way home, I miss Maubeuge. And then this is Joubert's diary, and this is rather priceless. He says, first reconnaissance with Mapplebeck, lost myself most thoroughly, landed at Tournai where I had lunch with the governor, and again at Courtrai where I was taken for a German until rescued by the Irish inhabitants. You see that? What he means by that is that there was a man from Belfast, fortunately, living there. He was arrested as he came down. They thought he was German. He started swearing in English. The Irishman, the man from Belfast, recognized him as Englishman, said, no, he's one of ours, and he was taken off for yet another lunch. So very haphazard at the beginning, not an auspicious start. So what was the reaction of the powers that be to this kind of reconnaissance? Well, Second Lieutenant Cuthbert Rabliati was at Maubeuge with No. 5 Squadron. And this is his reaction. This is what he remembers of the reaction that he received on bringing his reports to Sir John French, who, bear in mind, was the Commander-in-Chief of the British Expeditionary Force. He says, I took off from Maubeuge, and I was told I should see some advancing German troops, and I was very excited as I looked for them. So I flew up to about 3,500 feet so that I could see clearly. And you were very limited in your facilities. You had a map strapped on one knee and a pad with a pencil on the other, and it was all rather wobbling about. And as soon as I got over the area, I didn't see some German troops. I saw the whole area covered with hordes of German uniforms. I saw infantry, cavalry, transport guns, all advancing. The whole place was simply alive with Germans. And I was completely horrified, because this was infinitely more than I'd been told to expect. So I came roaring back and landed, whereupon I was put in a motor car by my squadron commander and taken off to GHQ in a chateau some miles away. And I was ushered into a room with a lot of elderly gentlemen covered in gold lace and all the rest. And they were all generals, and one of them was Sir John French. I'd been brought into his personal conference. And somebody announced me, and Sir John said, "Ah, here's a boy from the Flying Corps. Come and sit down." So I was rather terrifiedly put next to him. And he said, "Now, where have you been? Have you been flying?" And I showed him my map, and it was marked out. And I explained to him what I'd seen. And he and the others were interested, very interested. But when I began reading the accurate figures that I'd estimated, they just seemed to look at each other and shrug their shoulders. And then French turned to me and said, "Now, my boy, tell me about an aeroplane. What can you do when you're in the machines? Are they very dangerous? Are they cold? Can you see anything?" And I simply couldn't bring him down to earth because he wasn't interested in what I was trying to tell him. So was the Flying Corps going to amount simply to peripheral figures flying pointless novelties? Well, on the 22nd of August, the Flying Corps' luck began to change, because on that day, you had 12 important reconnaissance flights mounted. First one went out with this man, Captain Gordon Shepherd. He and his observer brought back information that large bodies of German troops were moving towards the British positions. Then this pilot, Vivian Wadham, brought back news here that towns and villages were on fire, that large German units were on the move. And finally, the news came in that the 1st German Army was actually now moving west in an attempt to outflank and encircle the British Army. Now, the Commander-in-Chief of the Flying Corps took this information personally to French, to General Headquarters. He realized that was the only way it would be taken seriously, and it was taken seriously. And the direct result was the Battle of Mons, at which the British held the German army before beginning its famous retreat. So we're looking at a real shift in perception at this precise time. But let's just go back to this man, Gordon Shepherd, the man who brought back the first crucial reconnaissance. He was a very interesting man. He would become the highest ranking Flying Corps officer killed in action, but he was something else entirely. This man had gone on leave the month before in order to sail an enormous consignment of German rifles and ammunition to Ireland, and then to organize their unloading at Howth near Dublin. This man was smuggling guns to Irish radicals to use against the British. These were the guns used in the 1916 Easter Rising. And they were brought to Ireland and unloaded by a serving officer of the Royal Flying Corps. And I hope you're getting a sense of why I say that the flying services attracted unusual people. That's just a little sideways. But he and his fellow flyers continued to impress during the retreat from Mons, carrying out effective, reliable reconnaissance. And the generals really started to pay attention. So during these few weeks, aeroplanes were really establishing themselves as reliable reconnaissance machines. They were seizing the reconnaissance role from the cavalry, just what the War Office feared. And as the Germans' advance was halted before the Battle of the Marne, the aeroplane was praised by Sir John French, who wrote in a dispatch, "I wish particularly to bring to your lordship's notice the admirable work done by the Royal Flying Corps under Sir David Henderson. Their skill, energy, and perseverance have been beyond all praise. Fired at constantly by friend and foe, not hesitating to fly in every kind of weather, they have remained undaunted throughout." So there's your snapshot in time, the aeroplane establishing its place in modern warfare. Now, there were, of course, plenty of problems. The fact is that artillery, anti-aircraft fire, began being used very early on from almost the beginning, and it quickly picked up the nickname Archie. Have you heard this? In the First World War, it was known as Archie. Why was it known as Archie? Well, listen to this. No. Am I going to have to sing this song? I think I might have to sing it.
Archibald, shut them in up. Desist at once, disrobing on the spot. You may show your black and sage, Miss Hewitt, but if you've got the strength to do it, Archibald, certainly not.
Archibald, certainly not, a song by George Robey, very popular at the time, about an errant husband who keeps getting into scrapes with a Miss Hewitt and his wife is not happy at all. Now, an airman called Amius Biffy Boughton, was flying one day at the beginning of the war. He was being attacked by anti-aircraft fire. It was peppered by anti-aircraft fire, but he landed safely, and as he came down and as he got out of his aircraft, he was singing, "Archibald, certainly not." And from that moment, anti-aircraft fire became known as Archie. Unfortunately, not in the Second World War, so most people haven't heard of it, but it's rather a nice thing. And here also you see a letter from around, this is October, from David Henderson, Commander-in-Chief of the Flying Corps, informing the French that from now on we will be marking our aircraft with these roundels, which are effectively a copy of the French roundels, but the colours reversed. The reason is aeroplanes were unmarked at the beginning of the war, but they were shot at by their own side. The Germans started putting black crosses on. The British responded by putting Union flags on the underside, but they were being mistaken for the German crosses, and so the British then copied what the French were doing and reversed it, and of course that's remained very familiar ever since. So the aeroplane's initial role was as the primary means of reconnaissance, a role it consolidated as the mobile war ended and the race to the sea begun. The race to the sea, this is, of course, the attempt by both sides to outflank each other, leading to that line of trenches stretching from Switzerland at one end to the North Sea at the other. The war that we know the First World War to be, the war of mud and attrition. And trenches obviously made reconnaissance by any other means a virtual impossibility. So aviation became about seeing. And that was the same for all sides. But for reconnaissance purposes, obviously a drawing or a description could only include limited detail, and the obvious improvement was to start taking photographs from the air. So from early 1915, you had a Flying Corps photographic unit, and the first official camera was known as the A-type. It was a big mahogany box, about 10 pounds, and the observer would simply dangle it over the side of the plane. The idea was that he would take pictures at regular intervals, which would then be developed on the ground, and you'd have a kind of mosaic map of the enemy front line. This then developed. You had much more automatic cameras. They were attached to the side of the plane. Developments took place, but the idea remained the same. And this is a mosaic map of the German side of the lines from 1917. And here is the key that goes with it. And I find this absolutely fascinating, because if you look here, I mean, it underlines certain things that they quickly picked up. Any kind of light color means recent digging. And so, you know, you can see where the trenches have been dug, and they can map those out. But you also see, so here, for example, you know, there's a lot of white around there. They say dug out under construction, so that's particularly recent digging. I have no idea why they say man standing here. I don't know how big that man is, but it's really very interesting to see just how, you know, they can make out latrines, dugouts here. And what's so interesting is that I showed not this map, but a similar map to a modern day RAF intelligence officer, and he said, you know, what we do is precisely the same job. And he was able to read the map I showed him. You know, things hadn't moved on sufficiently that, you know, he couldn't recognize his job being done in 1917. And you had this novel situation, I suppose, if you think about it, where the collection of technical information, the photograph, became more important, or was becoming more important, than information gathered from human sources. So this is an interesting change in warfare. Some photographs could prove more interesting than others. I don't know if anybody can guess where that is. Anyone? No, someone said Palestine. This is Jerusalem. Well, let me read you the account. This is Eric Roberts was in one squadron of the Australian Flying Corps. In early 17, he was in Palestine, and this is what he says. He says, "I was detailed with Ross Smith to find an enemy aerodrome. My first flight with Ross, we flew all around the Dead Sea across to the Mecca-Medina Railroad. We couldn't find a thing, and we flew over Jerusalem on the way, and I remember very vividly seeing it from the air. I had a camera, and I got him to take a photograph. It's the first photograph ever taken of Jerusalem from the air. And what's so fascinating about it is the size. It really is just the old city. There's basically nothing outside of it. And you can make it all out. I mean, you've got the Temple Mount, you've got Dome of the Rock, the Western Wall is there, Church of the Holy Sepulchre there, Damascus Gate over here, Via Dolorosa is up there somewhere. I mean, it's just, I find it very moving to see that. He just happened to take that photograph as he was passing over. But what else could aeroplanes do? Well, as the Western Front stabilized into a line of trenches, so artillery became the most important weapon of the war. If you were mounting an attack, a barrage would have to be laid down to destroy the opposing defenses. And conversely, when you were defending against an attack, enemy guns would have to be destroyed to prevent them from doing the same thing. So it was crucial to know the precise location of your enemy targets, and once located, to be able to fire accurately on them. Now, in the past, that had been done using forward location posts, but observers couldn't get forward any longer. So what was the answer? Well, the answer was airborne observation posts, aeroplanes. This is a page from a manual of the time, and it shows how it was done. This is the clock code. And this is a piece of celluloid with a clock code on it, on top of a map. And basically, what would happen was toward the end of the war, actually, the pilot did it himself. At the beginning, it was more, or earlier on, it was more the observer. But your battery, would fire, and its shell would land wherever it landed. And then, using your target as a center point and north, you would then work out where the shell landed. C6, and you would wire that with a wireless machine, Stirling machine, you had in your cockpit back to the battery. The battery would then alter their aim until eventually they hit the target. And so once you had zone calls, which meant that airplanes could just take over a battery anywhere, if they saw a target, then you had subalterns in the flying corps who effectively had more power than the senior officer in the battery. So these jobs, the reconnaissance, the artillery observation, later on things like contact patrol to see how far your soldiers had gone in an attack, these were the food and drink of the flying corps. These were the office jobs. And they were what started to turn aircraft really into fighting machines. Because when people think of the First World War in the air, they think of the Red Baron, they think of fighter pilots. But why were the fighters there? Why? I mean, expensive planes weren't just sent over the Western Front to shoot each other out of the sky. There would be no point to that whatsoever. No, aircraft were there primarily to do the useful jobs in support of the army, and fighter aircraft developed to defend them as they did those jobs and to attack the enemy while they were doing their own jobs. Because I may be talking about the British at this point, but the other Germans were doing the same thing back. And that's how dogfights began, the war within a war, the chivalric duels that the public grew to adore. Because, you know, in a basically mechanized war where everything happened a great distance, you had here people actually coming up against each other. This was as close as you got, really, to a personal war. And that's why the public latched onto it. So how did dogfights begin? Well, at the very start, it's true, rival pilots simply did wave as they passed each other. We're all airmen, let's wave. But it was only a matter of days, really, weeks at most, before men started taking revolvers and rifles up to take pot shots at each other, because after all, shouldn't we try to stop them? I mean, we're at war. For a while afterwards, machine guns were mounted on the side of aircraft, but they were pointing away from the propeller, so it wouldn't shoot through the propeller. That was almost useless. So the race was on to mount a machine gun effectively, and that race led to Anthony Fokker's synchronized machine gun, which threatened to drive the Royal Air Force from the skies in late 1915, early 1916. That's my own model at home, but it makes its point. Put simply, the idea behind this was that every revolution of the propeller triggered the machine gun. So the propeller was always out of the way when the machine gun fired. And now the important point, is the pilot could aim the gun by aiming the plane. So the entire aircraft was now a weapon. And what began to develop were the gladiatorial battles to the death, the rise of the great aces. And perhaps the classic dogfight of the war was described by the Red Baron, Manfred von Richthofen, in his diary. It took place in November 1916, between Richthofen and the first true British ace, Lano Hawker, of 24 Squadron. There's Hawker. He's about to go up. He actually invented fug boots. He's wearing fug boots here. He had them made by Harrods. And so Harrods, if you particularly wanted a pair of fug boots in 1916, you could go to Harrods and get them, thanks to him. And you can see, I mean, it was cold, and these people had to improvise. You know, that's what kept him warm up there. This is Richthofen. Here he is, and there with his famous dog. And here he is with members of his Yasta. And there he is in slight close-up, squinting into the sun. The hut in the sun, I suppose you could say. And here are the aircraft that both men were flying at this time. And you have Hawker in the DH-2. You can see, again, that's a pusher. Top speed of 85 miles an hour. Had a single Lewis machine gun pointing forward with a drum containing 87 rounds. And there you have Richthofen's Albatross. He wasn't yet flying the famous triplane. He was flying the Albatross. This had a top speed of 109 miles per hour as opposed to 85. And it had two twin Spandau belt-fed synchronized machine guns containing hundreds of rounds. So bear that in mind. This is what Richthofen wrote in his diary about the fight. He said, "The Englishman tried to catch me up in the rear while I tried to get behind him. So we circled round and round like madmen after one another at an altitude of about 10,000 feet. Each tried to get behind and above the other. Soon I discovered I was not meeting a beginner. He had not the slightest intention to break off the fight. He was traveling in a box which turned beautifully. However, my packing case was better at climbing than his. But I succeeded at last in getting above and beyond my English waltzing partner. When we got down to about 6,000 feet, my opponent ought to have discovered that it was time for him to take his leave. But the gallant fellow was full of pluck, and when we got down to about 3,000 feet, he merrily waved as if he would say, 'Well, how do you do?' I had time to take a good look at my opponent. I looked down into his carriage and could see every movement of his head. When he had come down to about 300 feet, he tried to escape by flying in a zigzag course, which makes it difficult for an observer on the ground to shoot, and that was my most favorable moment. I followed him, firing all the time. My opponent fell shot through the head, 150 feet behind our line." This is Richthofen's room. This is where he slept. Now, Richthofen was a hunter in his personal life as well. That was his passion, was hunting. He was a hunter in his professional life too, and these are the serial numbers of aircraft that he has shot down. And there's the rotary engine of an aircraft that he has shot down. That's his chandelier. This is how he relaxed and went to sleep at night, surrounded by these mementos. It wouldn't put me to sleep, but we're very different people, I suppose. This here is an airfield on the Somme, Vergeland, in 1916. Now, these, you can see, are DH-2s, all lined up, ready to go. This is a farmhouse. I mean, most of these, the airfields at the time, they were suitable fields and often attached to farms. So the farmhouse was the officer's mess. Here you have tents in front where people slept. And here it is a couple of years ago. And I find this very moving. All really that's missing are the DH-2s. Everything else is there. There's also another addition. That man there is in the third row of the audience today, but I won't embarrass him by pointing him out. Mark. So I hope one thing that's becoming clear. As time was passing, developments were coming quickly. And it's very important to note that those developments, or most of them anyway, were coming from the young men themselves. The innovators in this new world of aviation were the pilots, the observers, the riggers, the fitters, the people who knew what an aeroplane could do, what it couldn't do. They were ceaselessly innovating. If something worked, they persevered. If it didn't work, they simply tried something else. They discarded it and tried something else. It's how bombing developed. I mean, it's funny to think, almost, but at the beginning of the war, oh, sorry, I didn't show you this. This is Lano Hawker's crash site. Went here a couple of years ago. And there is now, very recently put there, a monument that's exactly where Hawker fell. Back to bombing. This is a flechette. It's a dart. The beginning of the war, darts were tossed over the side of planes. If you were underneath one, horrible, but it's clearly not a weapon of mass destruction. But the developments took place quickly. Cuthbert Ragliati very nearly lost his life, together with Louis Strange, attempting a very early bombing mission. And this is what he says. He says, in these early days, we were experimenting. And on one occasion, we were trying to drop out 7-pound shrapnel bombs. They were 4 inches wide, 8 or 10 inches long. And in order to clear the wings and struts of the aircraft, I thought I would put a tin tube through the floor of my Avro machine so I could push the bomb straight through and it would have no obstruction until it was clear of the airplane. Now, I little thought that the wind blowing the bottom of the tube would flatten it. So, very gaily, I pushed a bomb down and it got stuck in the tube below the level of the wheels. And I tried everything I could think of, but I couldn't get it out. I couldn't budge it. I even tried to climb out over the side, but I couldn't. So I passed a note back to my pilot, Louis Strange, telling him what had happened. And I watched him read it, and I watched his face. It was quite a sight. And we flew around for a long time. We came back to the squadron. We came very low. And I wrote a message, and I put it in a message bag, and I dropped it down in front of the hangars, telling them what had happened, and that when we landed, to keep well away, because the aircraft was going to blow up. And so then we came into land right at the far end of the aerodrome, because we were for it. We didn't want to blow everyone else up as well. And I suppose Louis Strange was a bit scared, and he landed much faster than usual. And we skimmed along the ground. And the edge of the aerodrome was covered in uncut corn, which was quite high. And what happened was that the stalks of corn wrapped themselves around the detonator of the bomb and wrenched it out. So when we finally landed, there was no detonator, and we got down successfully. But if you can imagine the feeling of touching the ground, drawing your knees right up, knowing perfectly well that this is the end, and then suddenly there's a bounce, and another bounce, and the lack of incident was absolutely terrific. And I leapt out of the machine while it was still running, and Louis Strange must have done the same, because when it finally came to a stop, we were lying very near each other in silence. And I got up to go back to the aircraft, and he started screaming, "For God's sake, stay still. You've done enough damage for one day." That was 1915. And just 3 years later, in late 1918, Handley Page heavy bombers were mounting strategic raids on German cities. And then, of course, 27 years later, 1945, you had the atomic bomb. So I hope you're beginning to feel that the rhythm of development, that rapid, extraordinarily rapid rhythm of development. And bear in mind also, this wasn't just a new kind of warfare. It was also a new kind of soldier, because in a world where the men themselves knew what was possible, but the generals and the staff officers didn't, where no rule book yet existed, an unusually individualistic service developed. And the airmen's lives were very unusual, individualistic too. Airmen, after all, were living on the Western Front, anyway, in relative comfort, several miles behind the lines, out of range of guns. They were in chateaus, in farmhouses. They were eating well. They were going into town in the evenings. They were even, on one squadron, putting on plays. Robert Lorraine was a squadron commander. He was also a very successful West End actor. And he decided to build a theater on his squadron. And he had the men putting on plays. So you quite literally had people going up, flying 3-4 times a day, 5 times a day, coming back, and then putting on a play in the evening. You would imagine that stage fright didn't hold much fear for these people. At one point, he invited his good friend George Bernard Shaw to the squadron, and he put on 2 Shaw plays. One was put on by the men, one was put on by the officers. The one put on by the officers was an anti-war play called Perusalem VC, and Shaw sat there and watched it and laughed all the way through. His shoulders were seen heaving up and down with laughter. It wasn't a comedy. And one of the airmen took real exception to this, that Shaw had come. They were trying their hardest, and he was laughing all the way through. And he went up to him afterward, and he said, "You know, why were you laughing?" And Shaw said, "If I knew it was going to be like that, my friend, I wouldn't have written it." Which seems rather ungracious, considering these men, they were not primarily actors, but this was happening on the Western Front. And you find all kinds of stories of people doing things to make life as normal as possible. So you had tourists. You had airmen who would, on the days off, would go into the towns while the towns were still intact to look at the churches. You had a man brought hounds back and went hunting behind the lines. Another squadron, they built a large skating rink. All these things were happening on the Western Front during the war. But then look at the, on the other hand, by the time of the Battle of Arras in April 1917, the average life expectancy of a new pilot was a little over 2 weeks. They were arriving barely trained. So you were doing potentially the most dangerous thing you could do on the Western Front several times a day. I mean, if you were an infantryman, then obviously a push or a trench raid were enormously dangerous, but you weren't in the front line all of the time. If you were flying and if you were successful, you remained flying. On top of that, the Royal Flying Corps carried no parachutes. The Germans did carry parachutes in 1918. A communique of the Air Board said, we will not issue parachutes because they will impair a fighting spirit. In other words, people will be tempted to bail out if they have a parachute. So they weren't issued parachutes. One man, one pilot, was so angry that after the war he published his autobiography, and that's what he called it. The anger remained with him. And even the greatest pilot suffered from fears. This is Mick Manock, the highest scoring Allied ace of the war. Very interesting man. Not a typical pilot. He was raised in poverty from a broken home. True hatred of the class system. Not typical at all. But greatly loved by the men under his command. He nurtured them. But he suffered from terrible fears throughout his career. Early on in his career, in fact, he was considered a coward by others that he flew with because he refused to take unnecessary risks. But the more successful he became, he was formulating rules of flying. He wanted to stay alive, and he wanted others to stay alive. And yet, the more successful he became, the greater his fears and his neurosis became. And this is what a friend of his closest friend, when he came home on leave, said about his visit home. He said, "We were sitting in the front room talking quietly when his eyes fell to the floor, and he started to tremble violently. And this grew into convulsive straining. He cried uncontrollably, muttering something that I couldn't make out. And his face, when he lifted it, was a terrible sight. Saliva and tears were running down his face. He couldn't stop it. His collar and shirt front were soaked through." He couldn't show that on the squadron, but when he went home, it was all released. And from that state, it wasn't far to a breakdown. And there were many, many, I've been through many of these hospital medical records talking about flying sickness, neurasthenia. And actually, flyers were dealt with very sympathetically compared to infantrymen. They were basically sent home for rescuers, or they were sent to desk jobs at home. And the reason is because the people who were responsible for dealing with them had been through this themselves. They'd been flyers themselves. They knew the pressures. They understood what they were under. So they weren't marked out as cowards. Back to Manock, before he could suffer a breakdown, he was killed. Now, he used to carry a revolver with him in his cockpit because his great fear was burning, and he wanted to shoot himself rather than burn. And this man shows you the intensity of life on the Western Front as a flyer. He went from a raw novice, complete novice, to the greatest airman of the war, British airman of the war, in 16 months. That's how quick it was. And he died breaking one of his own fundamental rules, a rule which he had recently written out for young members of his squadron: do not follow the enemy down to the ground once you've shot him down, because then you're making yourself vulnerable. And it's extraordinary how many pilots, successful pilots, died breaking their own rules. Another one who did was our old friend Richthofen. Now, the circumstances of his last flight have been talked about. I'm going to talk about it here because it is quite fascinating. What seems to happen was this. His flying circus, as it was known, which was a collection of squadrons, was brought down to the Somme in 1918 to help win superiority in advance of the coming German offensive in the area. And they were known as a flying circus for a couple of reasons. One, they were all brightly colored. The Germans colored their airplanes. Richthofen's famously was all red. But mainly because they would move up and down the front to where they were needed. So if they were needed in a particular area, like they were now, they would move to this area, they could quickly reassemble there. They were a flying circus. Now, he wasn't flying the Albatross anymore. He was now in his all-red Fokker triplane, designed by Anton Fokker, who, incidentally, had offered his services to the British before he'd offered it to the Germans. He was Dutch, he wasn't German. The British had turned him down, and he became a designer for the British. And the Fokker triplane was, in turn, actually based on the Sopwith triplane, which had been designed by Tommy Sopwith. Royal Flying Corps never had it. It was only the Royal Naval Air Service who used the Sopwith triplane. So on the morning of the 21st of April 18, Richthofen was on patrol along the River Somme, and he encountered a pair of British two-seaters, but he was having problems with his guns. His attack failed. And then he met a patrol of Sopwith camels of 209 Squadron, and there was a mass fight. And one of the camels contained a rookie pilot, new guy, Canadian, Wilfred May, known as WOP, who had been told by his squadron commander, Roy Brown, just steer clear, don't get involved, stay above, observe, just be an observer for this one. But then May saw a German aircraft zipping past, and that aircraft contained Richthofen's cousin, Wolfram von Richthofen. And impulsively, because these people were, for the most part, impulsive, he chased after it and immediately presented himself as a target to a red triplane that was waiting in the background with one eye on Wolfram, because he was looking after him. And the red triplane obviously contained the Red Baron, and he eased himself into position behind May. So then you have May firing on Wolfram von Richthofen, then his guns jammed, and he started to go home. May started to head for home. But now, Manfred von Richthofen, the Red Baron, was onto him, firing at him with his own guns, which were also misbehaving. Terrified, seeing behind him the greatest airman of all time, May came down from 12,000 feet to ground level, and he tried to zigzag. Now, actually, that was probably the worst thing he could do, because he was over his own territory, so he wasn't going to be fired at, but he was slowing himself down by zigzagging. So even though his Sopwith camel was quicker than the triplane, its speed counted for nothing because he was zigzagging. So then you had Roy Brown, who's May's experienced flight commander, seeing what was going on, breaking off from his big melee and flying down to attack Richthofen. He came in from behind to this train at an angle. He fired a burst and then flew on. And Richthofen, meanwhile, carried on chasing May along the Somme Valley, and they flew low here over the Morlancourt Ridge. Now, this is a photo taken a couple of years ago from the air. This is exactly, well, not exactly, but pretty much what you would have seen at the time. These brickworks here, they were there at the time. This is over the Morlancourt Ridge. And as Richthofen flew over the ridge, he arrived over Australian-held positions. And what seems to have happened, he seems to have come under fire from two Australian, so he's flying, Richthofen is flying up here, following May in this direction. There are two Australian machine gunners up here with a Lewis gun who are firing. And then there's a single Australian machine gunner somewhere over here firing in this direction. So Richthofen's coming up this way. Now, he suddenly realizes that he's coming under fire from the ground, not just by those, but by riflemen as well, by people with rifles. So he then basically executes a nimbleman turn, and he comes back this way. And then his machine, his aircraft, rears up here. It seemed to rear up in the air. Then it loses height, and then it makes a very rough emergency landing here, just there. Richthofen had been struck by a single 303 bullet, and when he was examined, it had come through his right hand, so it had come through the cockpit, first of all, the side of the plane, and under his arm, it had gone basically through his heart, and it came out underneath his left nipple. Instinctively, he stayed alive long enough to land the plane. The undercarriage broke off. Soldiers appeared from all over the place. He was still alive. He muttered something to the first man on the scene about being about to die, and he was dead within seconds. And the plane instantly was picked clean. by the way. Go on eBay, you can buy a piece of the plane. I mean, if you put all these pieces on eBay together, then you'll end up with a 747. But for many years, Roy Brown, no, that's not Roy Brown, that is Roy Brown, the Canadian flight commander, was officially credited with shooting down Richthofen. And he was certainly in pursuit, but recent evidence very strongly suggests that it wasn't Brown who shot him down, nor could it have been the two machine gunners up here. Who it seems to have been was the man, the machine gunner over there, Cedric Popkin, because once he had done his turn and was coming back, it was Popkin who could have hit him on the right-hand side. Now, of course, it's also possible that he was hit by a rifle bullet. You know, it's the rifle bullets and the machine gun bullets were the same, but so we don't know for sure. But the likelihood seems to be that it was this man Popkin firing after he had turned. Now, the fact it's interesting that Brown got the official credit, and he was always very evasive after the war when asked about it. It may well be that officially they decided, you know, we want to make it look as if one of our pilots is better than Richthofen. It's not so impressive if he's shot by a stray bullet from the ground. Much more impressive if he's shot by another pilot. I'll just tell you very quickly, Brown said something interesting in an interview many years later, because he was always asked about Richthofen. He always tried to get off the subject. He said, I couldn't really fly. Bear in mind, he's an experienced pilot at this time. But he said, speaking during the Second World War, I could not really fly in those days. I was never taught to fly in the army. I knew how to take off from the ground and get down again, and I could throw a machine around the sky. Our pilots might not have flown so well from a war standpoint if they had a lot of flying knowledge. The factors that made most for success were a quality of what might be described as foolhardy recklessness, which I find very interesting. After the war, he became a commercial pilot, and then he could fly, he says. But the fact is, Richthofen broke his own rule. He had just a month before written a will. Much of the will was advice to young pilots. He says, do not chase an opponent blindly over enemy territory. He'd written that, and that's just what he'd done. Why did he do that? Why did Manock do what he did? Why did so many break their own rules? I could go into a lot of pop psychology now about the fact that, you know, they were regaining control. You know, they were kept at the front for extraordinary length of period. They knew they were going to die. They didn't have any control over whether they died or not. The only control they could retain was how they... I ask you, talk about it amongst yourselves, because I'm fascinated. I'd love to have more idea of why that took place. I'm just going to finish, because I'm very aware that the vultures are hovering and the time is coming to an end. I'm just going to finish with this, which I find rather remarkable. This is a reconnaissance report from September, 13th of September 1914. It's a reconnaissance taking place 80 miles northeast of Paris on the River Aisne, where fighting was taking place at that time. And what this marks, this is a very lucky discovery, I think, because it marks the very beginning of trench warfare. The Germans had been advancing, they were halted at the Battle of the Marne, and they retreated to the Aisne. On the 12th of September, the Germans started digging trenches above the Aisne, and on the 14th, the Allies dug in directly facing those trenches. That's how the race to the sea began. That's how the war of trenches, attrition, mud, and misery began right there. And here we see a Royal Flying Corps observer noticing the start of that. He writes, field half a mile northwest of Rennes, being heavily bombarded. He's beaten me to it. Pilot observed trenches this field. This is the very start of the First World War as we know it. It's the start of modern warfare, and it's very, very fitting that it's an aeroplane that is there to see it. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.